Hey y'all, this is Sam and this is Crimology. Welcome to episode 150, season 6. I decided to not take a break this season and just to jump on into this season. Normally I take a 2-week break in between, but I've got like 4 or 5 episodes already written up, so I didn't really have a reason to take a break. And also with season 5 being the same theme as season 6, I also really didn't see a point in taking a break. So we are back with season 5. If you were not here for last season, what we're doing is we are doing the top case from all of the U.S. states. How we're choosing each state is we decided at the very beginning. The app that we post used to be called Anchor. Now it's called, I think, Podcasters for Spotify or something. And so what the app does is it breaks down your numbers by state. And like, this is the state that you have the most listens to, all the way down to the last state. So that's how I determined. My first thought was just to do alphabetical, but then I thought this was kind of a cool way to also do that is, let's see where your state is in our order. So if you've wondered why it's kind of always been random, that's why. So yeah, before we get started, we've got Instagram and Facebook that are both at Crimology Pod. Make sure to go over there and look at both of those. We post, obviously, pictures, but we also post our source material. There are some things that both Instagram or Facebook won't allow to be posted. There was one time that I posted just the picture of the face of a school shooter and it was flagged. And so it's very particular things that I post. One time I posted just a picture of Ted Bundy and it was flagged and it was removed. So sometimes I'm not able to post certain pictures of even the face of a person that we're talking about. So I post like a link to the person that I'm talking about. So sometimes the source material isn't just, hey, here's the websites that I looked at to kind of write this episode, but it's also crime photos that obviously I would never be allowed to post onto Instagram and things like that. So make sure to go check both of those things out. There's not one thing that I post on Instagram that's different than Facebook. Everything's the same on both. So you could really follow one page and you're set. We've got email that's crimologypod@gmail.com. You can send us really anything. We've had somebody who has emailed us about audio issues. We've had so many suggestions emailed. We've had people who have said in the past when Steven was here, he used to do like Steven's Corner, and he used to just kind of do a little bit of whatever he wanted to do. And so we've had people who have said, hey, if you could do like a certain kind of like another kind of crime in your episode as like a Steven's Corner kind of thing. So literally anything, send over there. This is obviously a podcast that you guys listen to, so want to do things that you guys would listen to. So send all of those over there. Thank you guys continuing to support and listen and just support our podcast. We are at 30,500 plays at the point of this recording, at least. And so that's just super cool that we keep growing and growing. And so, yeah, thank you guys just so much for supporting and coming back for season 6. So here we go. Let's get into episode 150, the Villisca Axe Murders. So this week's state is Iowa. So the first fun fact about Iowa is that we've never covered a case from this state. This is one of the few states that we don't already have a case that's already connected in some way to the state, but this is our first state that we haven't covered. Other fun facts, Iowa ranks first in the beef, pork, corn, soybean, and grain productions. Google says their hogs outnumber the people in Iowa 7-1. I say Google says because I don't know how it seems wild, so maybe it is true, but just in case not, Google says that. S'mores is their state snack. And then Iowa also has the most crookedest street in the world. So just from There are some states where I try to find these fun facts and there's just like nothing. Sorry to Michigan, but I also think Michigan was one of those states that there was like no fun facts. Like there wasn't even anything. I think Michigan was also one of those states that it hadn't set up their favorite, their like state fruit yet. So like there were so many things that you just couldn't figure out about Michigan. But Iowa was one of those states that I was like, look at you. Like you make it seem fun to come visit your state. Like you convinced me to come visit your state. Anyways, all of your fun facts were cool, Iowa. So congrats. So this week we're talking about 8 murders that have gone unsolved for 112 years. In Villisca, Iowa, about 8:30 a.m., the bodies of the Moore family and 2 family friends were all discovered dead in the Moore family home. So in the home, we have Joe Moore, who is the father, who was 43 years old. We have Sarah Moore, who is the mother, who was 39. And then their 4 children, Herman, who is 11, Catherine, who is 10, Boyd, who is 7, and Paul, who is 5. Now, the day before the murders, Joe and Sarah take their 4 children and 2 other children to a church event. The 2 other children were Lena Stillinger, who was 12, and her sister Ina, who was 8. They wanted to go to this church event, and they asked their parents, Lena and Ina asked their parents if they could go to this church event with the Moores and stay the night with them. So their parents agreed, they go to the church event. This church event was a children's like end of year party kind of thing where Sarah was the co-director of the whole event. So the event was over about 9:30 p.m. And so since Sarah was the co-director, she's got to stay, do some minor things, cleaning up, making sure everything's put away. And so after all of this event's done, they walk back home to the Moore's home. So we know that event ends at 9:30. We don't really know what time they leave. They could have been there for another hour cleaning up or maybe 5 minutes, you know, and had arrangements to maybe clean up another day. We don't really know exactly what time they left to go home, but we know the event ended at 9:30. When they got to the house, they all ate some cookies, had some milk before they all go to bed for the night. Now, around midnight on Sunday morning into early Monday morning, someone or a group of people or one person breaks into the Moore's home with an axe that they picked up in the family's backyard and kills all 8 people in the home. Now, around 7:30 a.m. on Monday, one of the Moore's neighbors starts to grow concerned when she doesn't see any movement at the Moore's home when everyone is regularly up and about at that time. They've got animals that they've got to go take care of. They've got chores that they got to do. And so it's Monday morning, like your rise and shine, let's go. And nobody's out and about. And so this woman just becomes a little bit concerned. So Joe owned a hardware store in town, and employees at the store were also getting concerned when they weren't able to get a hold of Joe. And when a customer was supposed to have a meeting with Joe that morning and he didn't show up, they grow more concerned. So the neighbor, Mary, decides to call Joe's brother, Ross, and just tell him about her concerns. Ross ends up coming to the home. He walks inside the home, and then he enters one of the first bedrooms on the ground floor of the home, and he sees 2 figures covered with a white sheet that had blood on it. Before looking through the rest of the home, Ross goes outside. He calls the employees at Joe's shop and has them go get Marshall Hank and send him to the house. Marshall Hank gets to the house about 8:30 a.m. And after walking around the house, Hank comes back outside and confirms that everyone inside was dead. He was also overheard saying, "Somebody is murdered in every bed in that house." Hank said he also found the murder weapon leaning against one of the walls in the last bedroom of the house where the Stillinger girls were found. Hank also said next to the axe was a 4-pound slab of bacon leaning against the wall. He also said in the kitchen was a plate of uneaten food and a cup of bloody water. Marshall Hank also said whoever was in there had searched through everyone's dressers for clothing in order to cover every mirror in the home, along with the glass of the front door. All of the victims were found with sheets over their heads, and they had all been hit with the axe between 20 to 30 times each. When Lena's body was examined, her nightgown had been pushed up and she was exposed. However, officials ruled out any sexual abuse. Lena also had a blood stain on her knee and some defensive wounds to her arms, but she was the only one to have these defensive wounds. Now, police had no leads. The family was well-liked, Joe had a great job, Sarah was a great mom, and their kids were well-behaved, and they were all active in their church. Neighbors and family had no idea of anyone who would want to hurt this family or anybody that had any kind of ill intent towards them. While police are looking for any information, they have someone come forward with a story about someone they met on a train the night of the murders. Police are told that at 5:19 a.m. on Monday, a Reverend Kelly left Villisca headed westbound on a train. While on this train, Reverend Kelly would tell some other passengers that there were 8 dead souls left in Villisca. He would say they were butchered in their beds while they slept. Now, this person claimed that the train left at 5:19. The bodies weren't found until around 8:30. So keep that in mind, right? So, like I said, but at the time in the morning, the bodies hadn't been discovered yet. So there was no way for him to know this information unless he was involved. Officers didn't really start to hear a lot more about Reverend Kelly until they start hearing stories about some letters he had written. Kelly wrote investigators and friends of the Moore family letters about the murders, where he seemed kind of obsessed with all of the details of the murders. When police asked Kelly about these letters he had written and asked if he had had more details about the murders, he said he was pretty sure he witnessed the murders himself. But let's look at Reverend Kelly's life. As a kid, Kelly suffered a mental breakdown that followed him into his adult life. He preached all over the country, but at the time of the murders was preaching in smaller churches in the area of the murders, where he was just known for his odd behavior. The discovery that Reverend Kelly arrived in Villisca the day before the murders and left early that Monday morning. He also returned to Villisca 2 weeks later after the murders, pretending to be a detective and joined a tour of the family's home. In the past, he had been convicted of sending obscene material through the mail to various people, and he had spent quite a bit of time in mental hospitals. Kelly was known to put ads out in the paper for employees, and when women would come to him to interview, he would tell them that they were to do the jobs naked. So it would be like, I need a house cleaner around the house, or I need someone to kind of do odd jobs around the house, but you got to do it naked. He had been caught peeking into women's homes, and all of these things doesn't mean you're a murderer, but these are just common things that you see that murderers like start doing before they kill. However, on August 31st, Kelly signed a confession of murder. He said God said to him that he needed to suffer the children to come unto me. Along with this confession, they had him leaving on a train right after the murders with information that only someone who was there would know. And he sent a bloody shirt to the cleaners only a couple days after the murders with no explanation of why. And then obviously they've got the confession. So like we've got all of this on Kelly. However, in 1917, a grand jury would end up acquitting Kelly twice for the murders, even with his confession. They felt like his mental health might be playing a factor in this case, and that he didn't really know what he was talking about, even though he knew specific details of the crimes. So to this day, about 112 years later, the murders have gone cold and they have remained unsolved. You can go and visit the house and go on a tour, and you can even stay the night in the house if you want to. It apparently has a lot of paranormal activity, so if you enjoy that kind of thing, you can always go and experience that if you want to. But this is one of those cases that, again, I can't remember what episode it was last week, but I feel it was the episode last week where you get a confession, and even though you've gotten confession, it doesn't end up your way. And so this is one of those cases where, do I think Reverend Kelly did it? Probably. There were some articles that even went into that Reverend Kelly could have been a little bit obsessed with Lena Stillinger, who was the friend who stayed with the Moors that night. She was the older of those two sisters. There were some articles that said that he had attended Sunday school, but just for Lena, and like seemed like he really was only interested in Lena. But there was just every article had a different story. So I didn't write about that because I didn't know how true it was, because it wasn't like I could find the same story twice in all of these different articles. So I didn't know if that was something that it was just kind of like a bad case of telephone, and if that kind of had been told and told and told. But that could also be a form of motive, is maybe Reverend Kelly did see Lena. Maybe she was a pretty little kid, and so maybe he kind of became obsessed with her, and figuring out that Lena was staying at the Moors, and maybe that's why Lena was the only one to be exposed. And so that's why I brought that point up, is that Lena was the only one to be in that position, but she wasn't touched and she wasn't sexually abused in any way. So there's also those side of things, but it is one of those where you're like, Reverend, you are the only one that has all of this information, and you admit to witnessing the murder, so there's only so much you can say before you're blamed for it. I also couldn't figure out details of what happened to Reverend Kelly after all of this. I assume that he went into, obviously, a mental hospital, but like I can see through articles, he had been out in and out of mental hospitals for his whole life. So I can never figure out how long he was in a facility after this, and if he was discharged fairly soon. I couldn't figure out any details about that, or where he was like years later in his life after these murders. So I don't know details like that either. But just the fact that this was the first case that we've covered for Iowa, and so it was one of the few cases that was kind of easier to pick a case because it was the first one. And so, yeah, episode 150. Like I said, Instagram, Facebook, look for all of those posts later on this week. And just thank you guys so much for listening and supporting and letting us have a season 6. When Steven and I started this at the very beginning, I just liked the idea of starting a podcast, and I feel like in the years that we've done this, everybody has started a podcast. And so when we started, and it was kind of like everybody kind of started around the same time, I really didn't expect this to go for a very long time. And so the fact that you guys just keep coming back and you keep listening, and not only listening, but you're interacting with us and you're giving us advice and you're giving us suggestions, that's what keeps us coming back. And so even though, like I said, it's really my scheduling conflicts, but even if Steven's not able to be here with me, it's something that I still want to do because it's still fun. And so just, yeah, thank you guys so much for listening and just being involved and being here. And so, yeah, this is episode 150. Thank you all so much. Like always, this is Sam, and this is Crimology.